Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 792. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about pine forests and palm trees, carnival and a cable car, beaches, and a really big volcano as we go to the island of Tenerife in the Canaries. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about Tenerife. I'd like to welcome back to the show Justin Barnes from justinandcrystal.com. And Justin has been on the show before talking about Turkmenistan and Hawaii, and today has come back to talk about Tenerife. Justin, welcome back to Amateur Traveler.
It's nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
And we're talking about Tenerife, so an island off the coast of Africa belonging to Spain.
Spain, yes.
What's your connection with Tenerife?
So I actually lived in Tenerife for a good chunk of 2021. I had visited there a couple times in 2019. And on the first day that my wife and I visited, it immediately reminded us of the Big Island of Hawaii and also a little bit of Southern California and kind of a great balance of both of those. And so we went back a second time around Christmas of 2019 to visit again and decided that we would like to make a go of it. We didn't know COVID was going to happen, but even despite that, we ended up moving there in early 2021 and had a great time living there when we did.
Excellent. And why should someone go to Tenerife?
Because it really is a great mixture of so many things. It has a lot of the natural beauty of Hawaii, of the Big Island. It reminds me a ton of the Big Island, but it has a lot more creature comforts because there's a lot more people than on the Big Island. It has a lot more of the creature comforts like you might find in Southern California or in Honolulu, for that matter, and all mixed together with a lot of tourists from all over Europe, because all of Europe tends to go there on holiday. And then obviously the Spanish culture that permeates through everything on the island.
Excellent. What kind of itinerary are you going to recommend for us?
Because the island is relatively easy to traverse because of good infrastructure all around the island, everything is reachable in 2 hours or less. So I think rather than staying in multiple places, it probably makes sense to just find the city that you feel most comfortable with, stay there and take various day trips. You can either rent a car, which usually is fairly inexpensive, or you can take the bus. We didn't own a car the entire time we lived there, and everywhere that I'm going to mention on the podcast today, we took a bus to on day trips. So it's a very easy island to get around on.
Excellent. And you say we could stay in one particular spot. Any particular home bases you're going to recommend for us?
I personally recommend Puerto de la Cruz in the north. Mm-hmm. The island is kind of shaped like a ladle, with the front of the ladle being the west end of the island, the bottom of the ladle being the south end of the island, that's where the south airport is, and then the northeast part of the island being kind of the handle of the ladle. And Puerto de la Cruz is kind of in the middle on the top. What I liked about Puerto is that unlike so many of the touristic areas in the south that reminded me of Waikiki or Las Vegas, with a lot of clubs, a lot of inexpensive bars, discos, that sort of thing, Puerto had a more relaxed vibe. You could still find whatever nightlife you were looking for, but you definitely felt like you were hanging out on a small town in Spain as opposed to a large party area.
Okay. And I'm going to wonder that because there's a tall mountain in the middle of the island, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, and a lot of the resorts are in the south part of the island, does that mean that that is the rain shadow, that the windward part of the island is the north and the leeward is the south, or what is the weather pattern?
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly right. The trade winds generally come from the north to northeast. As you mentioned, there is a giant mountain in the middle of the island, Mount Teide, which is the tallest mountain in Spain, over 12,000 feet. It's actually the third largest volcano in the world behind Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa on the Big Island of Hawaii. And so most of the weather hits the north side and leaves the south side relatively dry. But unlike Hawaii, the wet side of the island is not that wet.
Okay.
There were only a handful of days where I didn't feel like going outside because it was too cold or too windy or too rainy. I think the north side of the island gets somewhere on the average of like 20 to 25 inches of rain a year, and the south maybe 10 or less. So it's not as big a difference as you see on the Big Island.
And if I found out what island has the fourth largest volcano in the world, would you be pitching me that next?
No.
Okay.
But I'm going to guess it might be New Guinea. I don't know.
Could be. Excellent.
Because you can stay in what I'll call a home base. In this case, I'm recommending Puerto, but honestly, you could stay anywhere on the island. I think what I'm going to do is go through the various areas of the island going around counterclockwise, and then I would recommend just taking day trips and coming back. Before I start with Puerto, I'll just start with Teide because it's kind of in the middle of the clock, so to speak. Like I said, it's the tallest mountain in Spain, the third largest volcano in the world. It's surrounded on all its slopes by a large native pine forest, which is one of the oldest native forests in Europe. It used to be all over Europe, but the latest ice age on mainland Europe, that all froze out. But on Madeira and Tenerife, there's still some of the native pine forest, which is nice to ascend through. And then once you get above the forest, it's very dry. You're above the clouds, and there are interesting hiking trails in a large caldera just below the peak. And then there's a large parking lot where you can get on a cable car to go up almost all the way to the top. And then there's more trails almost the very top of the mountain where you can see all across the island, especially on a clear day. And on especially clear days, you can actually see several of the other islands that are not too far away from Tenerife.
And let's talk about the pronunciation here too, because before the show I asked how to pronounce it and you said there's no standard and you decided we were going to use Tenerife, and then I went with Tenerife and you've been calling it Tenerife. So you lived there for a while and you heard a variety of pronunciations.
I did. I heard Tenerife with no pronunciation of the E. I've heard Tenerife, like almost like a UH sound, and Tenerife, like F-A-E type sound at the end. I heard all used interchangeably. I tried to get some sort of a concrete answer, but never did. And part of that may be that there's expats from Germany, expats from Britain that live all over the island. Plus, a lot of people on the island are not from Spain originally. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who have families in Venezuela and Cuba. So actually, unlike mainland Spain, the language is not the same. It sounds a lot more like Caribbean Spanish than Castellano.
Interesting. Okay. So getting back to the mountain, which is also a national park and a UNESCO World Heritage Site, you say you recommend that we go up there first. We get a great view. And are there any particular trails that you recommend while we're up there or other things that we're going to do?
There are a number of trails, I unfortunately can't remember the names, but they go through some large rock formations down in the caldera. Mm-hmm. This is near that parking lot that goes up to the cable car.
Okay.
But there are a bunch of interesting rock formations that are left from what must have been a cataclysmic eruption a long time ago, because there are big chunks of rock that are still there that are 50, 100 feet high with nothing next to them. And in and amongst the rocks is a native plant that vaguely resembles a silver sword like you might see on Maui. It's called the Tajanaste. It's an echium. It's related to the Pride of Madeira. That's kind of a common plant here in Southern California. But during the springtime, the Tajanastes bloom a bright red, and they're quite incredible. Also on the flanks of the mountain, particularly the western flanks, during February, there are almond trees that bloom this gorgeous pink color, sort of vaguely resembles like cherry blossom festival type thing from Japan. That's closer to Santiago del Teide on the western slopes of the island. But yeah, there's quite a bit to see, both in terms of geology and also plants going around the Teide area.
Okay. Anything else we want to talk about with Teide, or should we move along the clock?
I think probably move along. So I'm going to start, like I said, in Puerto de la Cruz, which is on the north shore, which is less crowded. And one of the reasons it's less crowded is that most of the beaches are along the south and the west part of the island.
Okay.
On the north shore, there's a lot more rocky beaches. And the slopes from the mountain down to the ocean are actually fairly steep, so it's kind of unusual to see a town right on the water, and Puerto de la Cruz is one of them. I'll say it's one of the flat areas on the north coastline. I use flat in quotes because it is definitely not flat, but it does go all the way to the coast, and there are a couple gorgeous beaches there, Playa Martianes and Playa Jardin, which are both black sand beaches. Right next to Playa Martianes is, I don't quite know how to describe it, it's called Lago Martianes, and it was designed by famous artist from the Canary Islands, Cesar Manrique. And this is an area with a bunch of swimming pools and bars and restaurants right next to the ocean, but in an area that I don't quite know how to describe it. It's kind of like a mixture of modern art and natural lava rock all mixed together with the water. It really blends in. I guess the way I would say it is you can tell it's not natural, but it blends in with the nature about as well as any installation of 10 swimming pools is going to look like. So that's a really nice area. Right near Playa Martianes and Lago Martianes is Playa de San Telmo, which is a nice walking path right along the coast. You can see the waves breaking. There's people out playing music, eating at outdoor restaurants. So it's a very nice place. A little up the hill from Lago Martianes and Playa San Telmo is an area called La Paz, which is where we lived, and there is a famous botanic garden that's there. It was built in 1788. And it actually houses a bunch of plants from all over the world because the original idea was that it was going to be an acclimatization garden to eventually bring plants back from, let's say, French Polynesia to Madrid. The thought process being we'll plant these all in the Canary Islands, we'll get them acclimated to the cooler weather of Spain and then bring them to mainland Spain. Well, they realized that didn't exactly work. You can only acclimatize plants so much. So as it stands, there are plants from all over the world, from all various Spanish explorers during the 16th and 1700s that are in this relatively small botanic garden in this relatively small town on the north shore of Tenerife. The plants there are frankly incredible because, like I said, they've been there for hundreds of years now in some cases.
Well, and I was going to ask you when you mentioned that one of your favorite beaches was Playa Jardin, if there was a garden nearby, is that the garden from which the beach gets its name?
I don't know, to be honest, because Playa Jardin is on the west part of Puerto.
It didn't look like it was near there. That's why I was wondering.
Yeah, the Playa Jardin is actually closest to Loro Parque, which is described as sort of halfway between like a zoo and SeaWorld, in that they do have shows with dolphins and killer whales and whatnot, a lot of birds. But then they also have, I believe, white tigers and some gorillas. It's definitely something for the children and the adults to enjoy. And that is maybe a two-minute walk from Playa Jardin. That's a very popular place. It had just opened, I believe it was last April, when it reopened post-COVID. Also in the La Paz area, there's a lookout that looks down right over Playa Martianes and Lago Martianes. You're basically up on a cliff overlooking the center of town, and especially on a clear day, you can see all the way down the coastline to the west and the east. And if you look over your left shoulder, you can see Teide, and that's one of the best, if not the best, views on the island. There's also a couple nice parks with great views in the center of the city, Parque Tauro and Parque Sortija, which have great views, nice fountains, jogging paths and walking paths through big grassy areas where you can have a picnic. People are jogging and doing their exercise. And then one of the last spots that I would recommend in Puerto is just west of Plaza de Charco, which is sort of the main square in town. There's a small neighborhood called La Reina, which has a bunch of street art all over several of the buildings. Art installations that are maybe 30 feet high, 40 feet high on some, on the sides of buildings with just interesting graffiti or whatever you'd like to call it. And then a ton of great restaurants on Calle Maquinas and Calle Del Lomo. You can't help but trip over a fantastic restaurant all around that area. So that's just a really nice area. And I should mention that all of Puerto is easily walkable. You can walk from one end of the city to the other probably in an hour and a half or something like that. Not that you would normally do that, but the point is I never needed a car ever. And like I said, you can take the bus. It's quite inexpensive, quite frequent. The taxis are also very inexpensive there. Uber is not a thing on Tenerife, but the taxis are very inexpensive, although knowing a little bit of Spanish probably helps your case if you're doing anything kind of odd or unusual that, that might need more of an explanation for the taxi driver.
Okay. ButcherBox is sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler, and I just got my first ButcherBox. I've got packed with dry ice came 4 packets of ground beef, 3 packets of chicken breasts, 2 steaks, some pork ribs, and some sirloin tips. Now, I've got a great recipe for what to do with the chicken. At least one of those packets of chicken is going to become Greek chicken and rice. And if you go to chris2x.com, I've got a recipe there that's an Instant Pot recipe. But I'm not good with steak, and so I'm going to take advantage of the fact that ButcherBox has recipes on their site at butcherbox.com to learn some great recipes to do with those steaks. You can have ButcherBox deliver meat to your doorstep. Free shipping as always, curated to custom box plans. You can easily find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust. 100% grass beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. Also like the fact that I could recycle all the box and shipping material that they sent. Sign up at butcherbox.com/traveler and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. Choose salmon, chicken, breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/traveler. If you got recipes for ribs or steaks, send them my way as I send my thanks to ButcherBox.com for sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler.
The next stop, I would say, is just uphill, so just to the south from Puerto de la Cruz, called La Orotava. There's a lot of historical buildings there dating back several centuries. It's a nice little compact area, lots to see. It's a workout to walk up there, so that might be something where it would be worthwhile to get a taxi or the bus up there. But there's a nice town hall. We were there one time around Christmas, and there was an installation of a whole room full of little miniature displays relating to Christmas that were, nothing was more than about 6 inches tall, and the amount of detail that they had used was incredible. So if you're there around Christmas time, I would definitely recommend that. There's a church, Church of Our Lady of the Conception, that dates back to 1516. There's an amazing restaurant called Casa Lercaro that's right near there. The building that it's in dates back to the 17th century. There's gardens. There's an area like a palace. I don't know what to call it exactly, but a palace-looking building that's a bright pink color called Liceo Tauro. That's quite impressive. So La Orotava is an area that you could probably see quite a bit in just a couple hours walking around, and not too many tourists, not very crowded at all. And now heading west, the next place I would recommend is called Icod. There's 3 main things to see in Icod. One is the Drago Millenario, which is the largest dragon tree on the island, maybe one of the largest dragon trees in the world. They call it Drago Millenario because it's supposedly 1,000 years old, but it is notoriously difficult trying to age a dragon tree because they don't have rings. So they kind of just guess from the amount of times that the branches have forked. A dragon tree, it kind of looks like if you took cauliflower or broccoli and made it about 100 times bigger.
Yeah.
You may have seen these if you ever visited LA or San Diego. They're not uncommon to see in Southern California, but they're all over the Canary Islands and particularly Tenerife. And the largest one is an Icod, and it's in a little park area. There's a native plant garden that's right there. And also right next door is a butterfly garden that's quite nice with a lot of different kinds of butterflies. It's not too large, but definitely something that people of all ages would really enjoy. They had some bright turquoise butterflies that I hadn't seen before. It's probably a 45-minute trip inside the butterfly garden, maybe 15 or 20 minutes to check out the dragon tree from the various vantage points. And then the other thing that I would recommend in Ikat is called Cueva del Viento, which is a extremely long, extremely large lava tube with tours that are run by some German expats, where they take you down in the lava tube, walk you through, kind of explain what was going on with the various lava flows, and explain to you what certain things on the roof or the sides or the ground mean in terms of the temperature of the lava or what was going on with the eruption. It was extremely well explained from a scientific standpoint. Plus, I mean, even if you didn't get the science, it was pretty cool just to see.
And Cueva del Diente, the Cave of the Tooth.
Cueva del Viento, Cave of the Wind.
Cave of the Wind. Oh, okay. Viento. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, my Spanish. I've worked on it. It's not quite up to snuff, but poco a poco, I'll get there. But this cave is so large, if you have any concerns about claustrophobia, I wouldn't worry too much. It was well over 10 or 15 feet high and maybe 20, 25 feet wide. So you never felt cramped down in there. At the very end of the tour, they actually show you one area where it caved in, and it caved in to a lava tube that was below the lava tube that you've been walking in. So it's one of the few documented areas on the planet where there was two lava tubes above and below one another. So that was kind of interesting.
Well, and we've talked about lava tubes probably with you before when we were talking about the Big Island, but basically for those who are not aware, when you have a stratovic volcano like the one in the center of Tenerife, then when lava flows down, obviously the top of the lava cools faster than the bottom of the lava because it's exposed to air. And what will happen quite often is it will crust over and the lava will continue to flow into this tube, and eventually the lava will flow out and leave a cave behind.
Yep, exactly.
So not a cave like your cave with stalactites and stalagmites, but interesting long linear caves that tend to go downhill, oddly enough.
Yes, actually that probably leads in well to the next location, which is Garachico, which is to the west of Ikat, still on the North Shore. It is a relatively small town, and the reason it's relatively small is it was heavily damaged by a lava flow from an eruption in 1706. It was the main port city on the island, and it had a very nice bay, but a lot of it was destroyed in a flow that sounded fairly cataclysmic from the descriptions I heard. It sounded like that was a particularly steep area of the island, and the lava was coming down like a waterfall into the town. But the part that remains is extremely picturesque. You can walk around the whole town in well under half a day. There are the El Caleton natural pools right along the coast there. There's a nice bay on the west end of the city with most of the city to the east. And you can kind of walk along the road there and get good views in every direction. There's a convent. There's an old church. There's an old fortress that's right along the coastline there. It's just one of the more picturesque spots on the island. So if you're in that area, I would definitely recommend stopping for a bit in Garachico, even if it's just to grab lunch. The next spot is now kind of moving from what I'll call the north to the northwest. And this is the area around Buena Vista del Norte and Punta del Teno. Punta del Teno is the very northwest part of the island. There's a lighthouse out there. You can take a bus from Buena Vista del Norte to Punta del Teno. It's a very short but very picturesque bus ride. And out at the lighthouse, there's good views out to La Gomera, which is one of the other Canary Islands. You can walk around a little bit, and then the bus comes back every hour, so you can just take the bus back into Buena Vista del Norte. If you head south from Buena Vista del Norte, you get into an area that's more off the beaten path, very green, very picturesque, but a little harder to get to. And it's the area that I'll call Teno Alto. And then a little further south than Teno Alto is Masca, which is famous in that it is perhaps arguably the most beautiful spot on the island. It's in this valley with jagged green peaks all around. Mm. And then a valley that goes all the way down to the ocean. There used to be, and there now is again, a hike that starts in the town of Maska and heads down towards the coast. It used to be that you would walk all the way to the water. There would be a boat that would pick you up and then drop you off in the tourist area just a little bit to the south. I believe at the moment you have to walk back up to Maska, so it's a little different. But even if you don't go on that hike, I would definitely recommend going to Maska, seeing the views, because they really are unlike a lot of the other views on the island. Like I said, just south of Maska, you get back into what I'll call civilization. And this is actually where a lot of the main touristic areas are. First, there's Santiago del Teide, which is where the highway starts slash ends. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but the highway goes around about 75% of the island, starting in Santiago del Teide in the west, circling all the way around to the south and up to the east to Santa Cruz, and then becomes the North Highway right around there, which then goes past the North Airport, past Puerto de la Cruz to Icod, and then around Icod, between Icod and Santiago del Teide, is smaller roads. They're still drivable. They're still fine. They're just not high-speed freeways. So if you're looking on the map, just bear in mind that in the northwest part of the island, you're not going to be driving 60 miles an hour.
I'm not going to void my rental car agreement or something like that.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Although I would recommend, because that road in Maska is, there's a lot of people who want to see it, and it's not the biggest road. So unless you are on a very fixed or tight schedule, that might be an area it would be worthwhile to take the bus, because there are buses that drive that road. It does go between Buena Vista del Norte and Santiago del Teide, all through there. And
okay.
We took that a couple times.
And if I'm going to drive it, I'm going to be on hairpin turns, it looks like.
Yeah, you're going to be driving quite slowly. The road is in great shape. It's just, mm-hmm. It's not very thick. It's not very wide.
Okay.
And you're going to be looking out at all the amazing views, so you're more prone to be distracted. So
sure.
Yeah, maybe take a bus.
Okay.
But yeah, now south of Santiago del Teide, you get into the area called Los Gigantes, which is the cliffs that are between the town of Los Gigantes and that beach that I was telling you about where you would come out in Maska. And these are cliffs along the west edge of the island that get as tall as, I think, 1,500 feet in some places. I don't know exactly what causes these. I was actually trying to read up on this last night to prep. My guess is that part of the island fell away, as happens every so often in Hawaii, for example. But I'm not sure. But yeah, there are 1,500-foot tall cliffs.
Well, I think the answer to your question is right there in the name. It's the Beach of the Giants. So clearly, they were caused by giants.
Yeah, could be. South of Los Gigantes, and by the way, you can get to Los Gigantes from the tourist areas to the south, which include Costa Adeje, Las Americas, Los Cristianos, and Gulf del Sur. Those are kind of the four of the tourist areas that are between where the highway starts in Santiago del Teide and where the South Airport is. The South Airport is the busier of the airports. It has more of the international flights, whereas the North Airport has more domestic flights to Madrid, Barcelona, and other places in mainland Spain.
And you say international flights, including a new one.
Oh, right. Yes. Starting in June, there is slated to be a direct flight from Newark to Tenerife South on United. So that could be very interesting, particularly because I'm sure they didn't plan this at the time, but now it may be at the same time as Carnival, since they moved Carnival to June. So if you're interested in going to Carnival and Tenerife, you might be able to fly there direct from the U.S. without having to go through any of the airports in Europe.
Well, and you say they move Carnival, and we haven't talked about that yet, but Carnival is normally in the usual time for Spain, not the time for Caribbean. Does Carnival near whenever the island was freed from slavery? Most of Europe does it around Lent, just before the beginning of Lent, and so that would have been, well, gosh, that's a little late this year, March, I think, this year.
Yeah, so I think their big Mardi Gras day would have been next Tuesday.
Yeah.
I was actually supposed to fly out, I think, today to go visit, because I didn't get a chance to visit last year because they had canceled it because of COVID, but then this year they postponed it because of COVID. So fingers crossed, I will see Carnival in June, because theoretically the Carnival in Tenerife is the second largest in the world behind Rio de Janeiro. So
The internet agrees with you that being the second biggest. So you can say it with more confidence than that.
All right.
I did look it up. And
all right. I believe you. I'm looking forward
and,
to it.
And we know the internet is always right.
Yes. So. Yes, for sure. So in the areas that I was talking about in the south, like Costa Adeje, Las Americas, et cetera, this is the area where you'll find inexpensive happy hours, discos, clubs, karaoke bars, all of the signs being in English everywhere, tons of expats and tourists from England and across the rest of Europe. And I like it, but it definitely has a different vibe than the rest of the island. Some of the things to see there, if that's not your cup of tea, are the boat trips to go to Los Gigantes. And then also you can take boat trips to see dolphins, whales, and pilot whales. We did that, and that was quite nice. We didn't see any whales, but we saw a ton of dolphins and a ton of pilot whales, which you haven't seen a pilot whale before. I describe it as being halfway between a dolphin and an orca, both in terms of its shape and its size. It kind of has a very stubby nose, and it's all black. It's about halfway. It's not quite as big as an orca. It's not quite as small as a dolphin. But those are reliably seen in the waters between Tenerife and La Gomera.
And so in terms of staying in that area, that would really be more for people like me who are all about the disco.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah, yes. So I don't mean to besmirch that at all. I stayed down that area for a long weekend, and it's nice, but it just doesn't seem as foreign.
Sure. Yeah.
As the rest of the island. Now moving a little further east from there, just east of the airport is an area called El Medano, which is famous for windsurfing and kitesurfing. There are always prevailing winds there, and the bay there is always full of people out windsurfing and kitesurfing. So if that is something you enjoy, I would definitely recommend El Medano.
If you've never watched kitesurfers, it's definitely something that is worth doing if you haven't done before. It's great fun.
Yeah. And there's actually a short peak, short mountain that's right near the airport where I think you can probably see the people kite surfing at El Medano. It's right near the airport. In fact, as you fly in and fly out, you can't help but tell that there's this little peak right along the coastline there on the south.
Got it.
Going east from the airport, there's not a lot between the south airport and the capital of Santa Cruz, with two limited exceptions. One is there's some pyramids in Güímar from the 19th century. They don't know exactly what they were created for. The best guess is for agricultural reasons, but it's this built-up area that kind of has these stair-step pyramids. And again, they don't know exactly the backstory there, but the best guess is for agriculture, getting flat land to be able to grow crops. And the other thing along that drive from the airport to Santa Cruz is the Basilica de Nuestra Señora de Candelaria, which was designated a minor basilica in 2011 by the whoever the Pope was in 2011. Santa Cruz is the largest city and the capital, but the reason that I didn't mention it up until now is that it's more of a working city. It is not so much a touristic area. There are nice things to see there, but it's a large city with over 200,000 people. Some of the things I would recommend there are the Palmitum, which is a giant palm garden built on top of what used to be the city's landfill, but now has great views of the town and of the coastline. It's very well laid out with good signage. Right by the Palmitum is Parque Maritimo Cesar Manrique, similar to the Lago Martianes public pools that I was describing earlier in Puerto de la Cruz. There's also a large auditorium that is based on a sail. To me, it looks vaguely like the Sydney Opera House, but there are musical performances there fairly regularly. There's also a couple nice museums in Santa Cruz, the Museum of Nature and Archaeology, which gives some background of the culture of the Guanches, which were the native people that lived on Tenerife before the colonizers came. That museum also has a description of the volcanism on the island and kind of what led to the shape that the island currently has, and then also has some information on marine biology in terms of what's in the ocean around the island. So that's a nice museum. And then also the Military History Museum has information about the chronological history of how the Canaries became part of Spain, about fighting off Admiral Nelson and the British back in the day. And it's built inside of an old fortress. So that's interesting. There's a nice shopping district on Camino del Castillo, right there in the middle of Santa Cruz. There's also a couple of nice parks. One that I particularly enjoy is Parque Garcia Sanabria, or Sanabria, I guess it would be, with tons of greenery, nice walking paths, plenty of shady spots, great place for a picnic or just to have a lazy day. And then there are some older items going back a couple hundred years, like Castillo de San Juan Bautista, Ermita de Nuestra Señora de Regla, and a bunch of other churches and fortresses that I would do a poor job pronouncing, but they're kind of along the Embarcadero area. There's a big Embarcadero in Santa Cruz near where the cruise ships come in, because cruise ships do come in all the time. We were actually on a cruise the first time we visited the island, and they all come in to Santa Cruz.
Okay, got it.
Right next to Santa Cruz is La Laguna. It's kind of tough to tell where La Laguna starts and Santa Cruz stops. But one thing that is specific to La Laguna is it has a historical center with a bunch of older churches and other buildings. That's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. I guess it was one of the first what they call Spanish settlements in the Americas, even though we're not quite in the Americas. But it kind of has that layout that became familiar and often used in Spanish settlements around North and South America. Kind of, I guess the best example I could give of something in the United States would be like the French Quarter, which was Spanish before it was French.
Okay.
Kind of that laid out like a grid, lots of buildings with balconies and whatnot. And La Laguna has a historical center with a very well-preserved old town dating back to the 1500s. La Laguna is also right next to the North Airport, which if you are coming from Barcelona or Madrid, is probably the airport you're going to come into. Just a random bit of trivia, the North Airport is the airport that was the site of the deadliest air crash ever back in the 70s.
Oh, gee.
Two 747s hit one another. That is not something you need to worry about anymore. I don't think any 747s come anywhere near that North Airport. And that was just a weird confluence of bad events that led to that. But one thing that came of that is I believe nowadays all air traffic controllers and pilots need to speak to each other in English, no matter where they are in the globe.
Right.
Because that day there was a translation snafu, which unfortunately had deadly results. But anyway, that is where the North Airport is, right near La Laguna. The one area that I haven't mentioned yet that's kind of what I'll call off the circle is in the northeast part of the island, and it's called Anaga. And Anaga doesn't have any of the major highways. It's got windy surface streets to get up there. It is extremely green. It is extremely gorgeous. It's very rugged. Valleys, mountains, cliffs, excellent hiking, great viewpoints from different parts of the island, and it's more or less been left alone as the rest of the island has been built up with cities and touristic places. Anaga is a place where you kind of go to get off the grid. I would say there's kind of four main areas that I think of in Anaga. The first one, moving from west to east, is the area of Bajamar and Punta del Hidalgo. This is kind of just north of La Laguna, kind of at the western edge of where the Anaga Mountains start. And this is an area where there's a ton of surfers because there's a very nice break there, giant bay. There's also some nice natural pools right near the ocean in Punta del Hidalgo. There's also a very interesting, futuristic-looking lighthouse there, and great views of the north coast and Teide. Just east of there is an area called Chinamata, which is one of the few places we were not able to get to by bus, because buses do not go there. But you can hike there from Punta del Hidalgo on what's an extremely nice but fairly challenging hike that kind of takes you straight up from the coast into the middle of Anaga. There's a great restaurant you can eat there in Chinamata, and then hike back down. So I think we got off the bus at 10 a.m., got to the top at around noon, had lunch at probably done by 12:45, and probably back in Punta del Hidalgo before 3. So Chinamata is amazing. A little east of there is an area called Almaciga and Banijo. I mean, these have some very remote beaches that you can walk to with. Some of them, I think, have black river rocks along with black sand down there. These are beaches where you're not going to see very many people at all. You're probably going to see all locals if you do walk there. And you really have no idea you're on an island with almost 1 million people. And then furthest to the east, in the northeast corner of the island, is the area around Chamorga. There is a small beach and some rocks called Roque Bermejo, where you can walk down there from Chamorga, and there's like a a little bar with beers and wine that's set up by just some random guy on the weekends because he knows that people are walking down there. It's a really nice beach. The day that we were down there, we were able to see Gran Canaria from across the ocean. Gran Canaria is to the southeast of Tenerife. There's a nice lighthouse, the Faro de Anaga, that is just uphill a little bit. There was an area of just above the Faro de Anaga where you could see the north shore and the east shore and the lighthouse and these giant rocks that are along the north shore that are out in the ocean and Gran Canaria. Again, that's one of the, if not the best viewpoint on the island, certainly way up there. The last thing in Anaga that I would say is there is a hike kind of in the middle of the park called a Sendero de los Sentidos, basically hike of the senses. And it's a forest hike that focuses on using all of your senses, touch, smell, sight. That's very interesting. And that's something that piques your interest. I would definitely recommend that as well.
Anything else we want to cover before we get to some of our wrap-up questions?
I know on most of these podcasts, people give a specific itinerary. I didn't give that this time because, like I said, you can use any place on the island as a base. I'm sure a lot of the places that sounded more interesting to some people would be less interesting to others. But with everything I said, if you were there for 7 days, my recommendation would be to spend one of the days going to the top of Teide and, again, get a reservation for the cable car if you can. Spending one day exploring Puerto de la Cruz and La Orotava. They're right next to each other. The third day, checking out Icod and Garachico. And if you want to go to that Cueva del Viento, I would recommend getting a ticket ahead of time for that as well. A fourth day, checking out Masca and the Teno Alto area. For that, I would check the weather beforehand, see what day is scheduled to have the best weather, and then go to Masca that day. Masca oftentimes can have cloudier weather than a lot of the other spots on the island, but that's why it's so green. I would visit Punta del Teno either the day that you go to Masca and Teno Alto or the day that you go to Icod and Garachico. Either one of those would fit well with Punta del Teno and Buena Vista del Norte. I would suggest going on one of the dolphin and whale tours and seeing Los Gigantes. That's a really nice area of the water, and you can get in whatever beachy club stuff you want to get in as well when you're in the area. And then I would spend a day in Anaga. If I was forced at gunpoint to choose one part of Anaga, I would say that area around Chamorga in the very far northeast. And then the seventh day, I would recommend going around Santa Cruz and La Laguna in the east. Oh, one other thing in Santa Cruz and La Laguna that I've neglected to mention is just northeast of Santa Cruz is a very popular beach called Playa de las Terracitas. Is the most popular beach on the island. Definitely the most popular with the locals.
Excellent. In terms of when to go, you are obviously doing a special trip to try and be there for Carnival.
Yes.
Any particular recommendations for when to go or when to avoid is the other question.
This is always interesting because I have a different answer on an absolute scale. The absolute scale, meaning when is the best weather, you're probably looking at April, May, or September, October. But on a relative scale, if you live in upstate New York, probably January is your best time to go.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's nice weather all time of year. They call it the land of eternal spring. And that reminds me that on that vein, this is one of the most colorful places I've ever seen. The landscaping everywhere you go just has all sorts of colorful trees, colorful shrubs, and seemingly no matter the time of year, something is in bloom. I showed up at the beginning of January, which is normally you would not think a very popular time for blooming plants, but there was flame vine, which is this striking bright orange vine that blooms during the middle of winter in the northern hemisphere, and it was everywhere. There's bougainvillea everywhere. There's hibiscus, plumeria, almost all of the tropical type trees that you would see in Hawaii, but then also some of the temperate and subtropical things like you might see in Florida and California. It all seems to grow in Tenerife. It's really striking. No matter where you go, no matter the time of year, you're going to feel like you're in a bright, colorful area.
I am a little curious. You visited the first time on a cruise ship.
Yes.
And you told me that you fell in love with Tenerife and decided to move there about an hour later.
Yes.
What did you do in that hour?
So we were taking the drive up from Santa Cruz to the top of Teide.
Okay.
And so we were going through the forest, and we had already driven through Santa Cruz and La Laguna. Then we had driven through this pristine pine forest. Now we were above the clouds. and we had our first view of Teide and what I'll call like the very volcanic area near the top. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of looked at each other in the back seat of the car, and I took out my phone and I pulled up a picture that I had on my phone and I showed it to our guide, and she had this confused look on her face, and she said, "I thought you said you haven't been here before." And I said, "That's not here. That's the Big Island of Hawaii." I showed her a picture that I had taken of Mauna Kea from the slopes mm-hmm. of Mauna Loa, and it looked almost identical. And so the rest of the day, we started peppering her with questions, not of like, "Oh, what's it like to live here?" and this and that. We were peppering her with questions like, "So how many mosquitoes are there? If you have an injury and you do have anything worse than a sprained ankle, do you need to fly back to Madrid?" All sorts of very, very specific questions that she was not expecting us to ask. But we knew immediately that it reminded us of the best things that we liked about Hawaii and Southern California, but kind of halfway in between. So yeah, that's what got us. And then we came back about 8 months later, just before Christmas. And it was just as nice then as very festive during the Christmas period. And then we decided to move there. So we did.
Excellent. Anything else before we get into our wrap up questions?
No, I think that covers it pretty well, I hope.
You're a veteran here, so you know what's coming. You were standing in the prettiest spot in Tenerife. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
So I'm going to go a little off the board here because for once, this would be something where I'm not standing, but I'm sitting.
Okay.
And the prettiest view that I have seen on the island is actually sitting in the front seat of a taxi coming from La Laguna and North Airport area, coming towards Puerto de la Cruz. You round a corner in the city of El Sausal, and all of a sudden before you, you have a mountain that during the winter has snow all over it. It's 12,000 feet high. Below that is a deep green forest and valley leading down to the coast, and you can see the mountains, the forest, the coastline, and the towns on the coastline all right before you, and the enormity of it is quite striking.
Excellent. And having lived there, one thing that makes you laugh and say only in Tenerife?
Walking through a neighborhood with million-dollar views of the mountain, of the beach, of everything, and having your view interrupted because there is a group of 100 goats that are being led down the street from their last job to their next job. You really realize that, yes, you are in a populated area, but the line between the populated areas and the rural areas, they're not quite as strident as in the U.S. You can go from rural to million-dollar views back to rural just like that.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize Tenerife in just three words, what three words would you use?
Colorful, photogenic,
okay.
Perfect.
Excellent. Excellent. Our guest again has been Justin Barnes. And Justin, if we sent people over to justinandcrystal.com, are they going to be able to read more about Tenerife?
Yes. I have my time from the cruise in 2019 that will have sort of like just the very highlights. But then there's a long post I have from 2021 when I lived there. Also has some of the lead up to what's going into moving there, which probably may or may not be of interest. But starting in January of 2021, all of the posts on that entry all relate to things that you can see and do there on the island.
Excellent. Justin, thanks so much for coming back on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Tenerife.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to the patrons of the show who help support Amateur Traveler financially for as little as $5 a month. They get an ad-free version, a monthly Zoom call, and they get it a little early, as well as first dibs at Amateur Traveler trips. And special thanks goes out to Dan Ponce, who is the latest patron of the show. I don't know for sure that there are any spots left on the Amateur Traveler trip to Turkey in September, but if you're interested in signing up to that, that is available to everyone now, and love to have you. And you can go to the URL amateurtraveler.com/turkey2022 to learn more information about that trip. If you have any questions, drop me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, again, send an email to me or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.